Why are you shining a flashlight at me?
Because to be able to record this bloody episode, I've effectively pulled off my own mini heist.
Sorry, you broke up. You've been pulling off what? You broke up on me there.
A mini heist.
It looks like you're in a toilet. A cubicle.
I'm in a security room. That's what I'm in. It actually feels like I pulled off my own mini heist to be able to record.
Sorry, you broke up with me again. You've been
pulled
pulling
off my own mini heist to be able to record this episode today. But I'm glad. I hope it's worth it. This is what I do in order to ensure that we've got listenable audio.
Ira, if it's not, I'll just throw a tantrum. I'll throw an absolute fucking rabbi and we'll have a great time on my show.
The best bits.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
You are stupid, you have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello and welcome to The Best Bits, the movie podcast where a two-man crew gather tools, set our alarms and pull off a heist, raiding the cinematic vaults for weirdly specific, randomly selected gems. I'm your co-host Kevin, the mastermind behind one and a bit films and four and a bit episodes of TV, and joining me once again is my partner in crime, a man no stranger to the game with three scores under his belt, a Christmas job and a Star Wars, Will Collins.
Sometimes I do feel like I'm a bit of a thief. I really do. The way I pull off a couple of those credits. How are you, Kevin? We're talking about heists.
We are. And I said this to you off mic, and I'm going to say it again now. This is our 69th episode of the main show. That's a lot of scene themes that we've gone through.
Yeah.
So we've covered a lot of ground. But honestly, when it comes to research, this has been my favourite topic we've done. It's been an absolute treat to discover so many great films, not just in this genre. It's been an absolute treat. The job's over. Cancel the fucking job. I'm going home.
You can't get the words out. That's it. The alarm, the security alarm has rung. The cops are on the way. We've been sprung.
Yeah, not just great films within this genre, but films that I've now come to absolute love as like some of my favorite films.
Yeah,
I've really been blown away. There was a lot of like blind spots that I had to sort out, so I'm not really going to talk about some of the really familiar films on this, ones that I've watched over the last 20 years. I want to talk about the ones I discovered for this episode, because I discovered some fucking bangers.
Same. And you say it almost every episode, like I say certain things almost every episode, and you say certain things.
You're not better than me.
And one of the things you say almost every episode is that you've been inspired to write, or you want to write something. And this is the first time where I truly, in researching a topic, I have been inspired to say, I want to write a heist movie.
I've written one. It starred Rita Ora as the Artful Dodger, and it inspired Michael Caine to formally retire.
You're not better than me.
Dick. Bing.
And I got nominated for a Razzie for it.
You and your cohorts.
Yeah, Twist was a rewrite job that came to me where they wanted it to play like a heist film. And so I took on the job. And then it didn't happen for about 11 years, and I was replaced by about 7 other writers.
Yeah.
And our combined collective effort managed to get us all Razzie nominations.
You see, the fact that there's how many writers, co-writers?
Well, Charles Dickens was the first.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, he fucked it up. So he's the guy who actually should have. Did he get nominated? Are we talking about Charles Dickens or Razzie nominations?
Okay. I think he did. And I think that's why they felt, you know, the Razzies is like a piss take.
Yeah.
So they felt like, oh, let's nominate this and spread the misery. So I don't know how many writers was on Twist, maybe 9.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Yeah. Well,
that's the bit in my intro, the one and a bit films, because I wrote a bit of it.
Yeah.
I wrote the whole bloody thing, but then you get rewritten and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. And
it effectively doesn't look like the thing that you wrote. By the end product doesn't reflect the thing that you originally wrote.
I wouldn't know because I never watched it.
Oh, yeah. We should do a watch along. We should do an audio commentary and watch it.
Yeah, let's torture Kevin. Yeah. That's fun.
Let's get the ball rolling. Okay, listen. I found some gems as well watching, doing research. And honestly, if I had another, I would have been happy to have had another couple of weeks to do extra research just to continue watching films in this genre and discovering more and more gems, because it feels like there's, it feels like I've just found the magic drawer. You know, you open a drawer that hasn't been opened.
Totally.
And you go, oh, look at this one. Well, I'll give this one a go. Oh my God, that's good. That's really good. And it just, the hits kept on coming. So I just can't wait to talk about them.
I remember doing disaster films and I was pulling my hair out. I was like, good God almighty, they're all fucking awful. Like one after the other is pretty bad.
Yeah.
And there was just, you know, the odd, averagely okay film. Ones that sort of really shocked me by how poor they were. This was the complete opposite. This was like, I just wanted to keep going. I just wanted, I'll try this one.
Yeah.
And I just kept getting rewarded. It was like minimum 4-star films across the board.
I want to say something that I haven't road tested because it just popped into my head. I think heist movies is the best genre. I think it's like the perfect film genre.
It's a point that I was going to make as well, but go on.
Yeah, because it's, first of all, you're doing something vicarious. You're experiencing something vicariously through these characters on screen. Stuff that every one of us have had those kind of wistful thinking.
Just like sex scenes.
Just like sex scenes. We've all had that moment of, I wonder how I'd get away with this job. I wonder how you'd actually rob a bank. And it's incredibly satisfying and titillating to go along with some characters who have that same goal and same ambition, and to see them pull it off, but also to see them plan for it, plot it out, execute it, and then witness the fallout. And that, for me, is a perfect kind of film structure.
Of all the topics that we do, you know, horror films, they're director-driven, comedies, it's performance, but with heists, it's script. The script needs to
That's true.
It needs to be top tier. And what you've got is you've got great characters, because it's all character driven, no matter what the machinations of the scheme that they're pulling off. You're following people that have got a detail about them and about their personality that gets you invested. Mm-hmm. There's something about them where they've got to pull off this job, whether it's a lark and it's a caper or whether it's something suspenseful. And on top of that, then it's just got great writing, because these heists, the really good ones, are pulled off with panache, and the writing needs to be top tier. You've got very clever scripts with great characterization. And then when you've got really good direction on top of it, you're sorted. It's like, they're just the most entertaining films.
Yeah. And even if you think about, I know this is stretching the idea a little bit further, but like what's considered one of the first fictional films, you know, definitely American fiction films, The Great Train Robbery essentially is a heist movie as well. You know, and that's going back to 1903. So one of the very first fictional movies ever made is a heist movie.
And one of the first heist films where it's silent, because I'm going to bring that up. That's something that I...
I think we might be. Well, we might be in lockstep, maybe. Go on.
There's a few films where the silence plays a key role, and oh my God, it was catnip. I was in heaven. I absolutely loved it. But look, I'm not going to jump the gun too much. What I want to do, I want to start off by saying, when I usually get a topic, you're whittling it down and whittling it down. You're thinking, what are the parameters here? Because we start quite broad and then we narrow it down into, what are the specifications and the categorizations that you can use in order to ring fence this topic so that you don't end up like drifting all over the place and you're doing typical crime films or, you know, another version of buddy cop movies or something. Like To Live and Die in LA. That's definitely a heist that they're pulling off. But there's two of them. There's not a team of them. They know each other beforehand. And I think that that's a key factor for me with heist films, is that it's a coming together of people who don't particularly know each other. They're coming together for this job.
Yeah.
And it's a group of people. So it's a collective effort. And when I was like going through it and sort of finding my way through this topic, I was going through a lot of lists, and films were coming up on the lists that weren't what I would consider traditional heist films. I fucking loved them. I absolutely loved them. I want to mention those first off to get them out of the way.
Go on.
All right. Well, this one might be on your list, but I feel I need to bring it up. Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
1:23 p.m. A crowded subway train starts its run from Pelham Station in the Bronx. 1:45 p.m., four desperate, heavily armed men seize control of the train.
Open the door or I'll blow your head off.
Taking 17 people as hostages.
Your attention, please. Now then, you'll all remain seated. Anybody who tries to rise is going to get shot. I do hope I have made myself understood.
2:13 p.m. The city of New York is given 1 hour to come up with $1 million ransom.
You're out of your skull!
No all units, stand by on the double.
What's up, Z?
A train's been hijacked.
There is no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
At precisely 3:13, we are going to begin executing the hostages.
Nothing will happen as long as you obey my orders.
New York City is held powerless in the grip of four ruthless men. From the mayor's office.
Don't tell me, I don't want to know.
To police headquarters.
I've got about 50 men inside the tunnel, all wearing vests and armed with machine and submachine guns. We could fight the Third World War down there.
It's, do you know what? I didn't have it on my list because I didn't think it was essentially...
Explain why.
Because I don't think it was a heist movie. I thought it was a hostage movie. I didn't think
it was a hostage movie.
Yeah, I didn't have it. I didn't have it as a heist movie, but it has a lot of the components of a heist movie, but it didn't make my list, even though if it was on my list, it'd be way up there. I love that film. It's a film I've discovered in probably in my teens. I had it on tape. I had it on DVD. I've watched it many, many times. A cracking score, incredible performances, compelling, interesting characters, but ultimately...
great faces.
Oh.
I was saying to you when I was watching it, it's like, we've fallen so far from where we should be in terms of putting stuff on screen. Films have just become so anonymous. And in order to make characters work now, because they're all so generic and pretty looking, they have to just fill them up with babbling bullshit dialogue. Mm-hmm. Whereas you go back to something like Taking Pelham 1-2-3 and it's just faces. Mm. It's the carriage of these people. They look like regular people. You don't need to know all the ins and outs. You just get a beat on them instantly. That guy is... that type of fella.
Yeah.
And there's not one good looking person in that cast. And I fucking loved it. It was.
I think Walter Matthau was sexy looking.
Especially that last look, that come to bed look he gives.
Listen, it's one of those films that I'm shocked I haven't brought up a million times already. But I'm kind of waiting. I know the topic that I would use it for. And it's kind of like later down the line. And, it's probably that scene I'm going to be bringing up particularly.
So I watched it for this. I'd seen the remake.
Oh, right.
And the remake is quite glossy. It's all the things that you'd expect from a Tony Scott film. The original is nothing like that. The original is gritty. It's thrilling, anamorphic lenses. It looks great. It's witty as well.
It's a fun
as much
film.
As there's so much. Yeah, Walter Matthau is very fun and he's got some great little patter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a hostage film. In fact, drawing a line from that to another film, which no one would consider to be a heist film, but it's more of a heist film than Taking a Pelham 1-2-3. I'm not going to really bring it up much, but to mention it, Die Hard could be convened as a heist film.
Yeah.
Because it's the whole motivation of Hans Gruber is to pull off a heist.
Yeah.
And he's masquerading as a terrorist.
You're amazing. You figured this all out already.
But we're not, the difference there is the story's not being told through the lens of Hans Gruber and his gang. It's been told through the lens of John McClane, who is... intercepting them.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
And the other one I want to mention, which blew me away, which I now consider to be a gold star classic, is Sexy Beast.
What's the worst thing that can happen? What's the worst scenario? He's going to come here, ask me, I'm going to say no.
Do the job.
No, Don.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
I can't.
You can.
I can't. Don't do this.
Do what? What am I doing?
This
what?
I know a bloke who knows a bloke who knows a bloke. Now, you know this bloke.
Do I?
This is a bloke you know. Wants me to put a team together.
Eight men. Strong. Good boys. Got to be good boys.
Look dumb.
Look dumb?
It's like this.
Like what?
I'd be useless.
Useless?
I would be.
In what way?
In every fucking way.
Why are you swearing? I'm not swearing.
You think you just make your dance, leave the table, lie on your pool like a fat blob laughing at me? Do you think I'm going to have that?
Do it.
Retired.
Do you think I'm stupid? Some twat.
I'm not really up to it.
Is your middle name ungrateful or what?
I'm retired.
Are you going to do the job? It's not a difficult question. Yes or no? Say it. You see, girl, where there's a will, and there is a will,
there's a way. There's always a way.
Oh, I haven't watched Sexy Beast. You mentioned it to me, and I was like, I'm not going to get a chance to see it. So, okay, I'm going to watch it.
There are a few films where the film is actually more about the aftermath of the heist. The heist has already happened, you know, like Reservoir Dogs or A Fish Called Wanda, which is a fantastic comedy. But the Fish Called Wanda opens with the jewel robbery taking place, and then it's all the double and triple and quadruple crosses, and it's about the blowback of that.
You told me you were not planning to see it!
Because I knew you would come along and fuck it up! I was dealing with something delicate, Otto. I'm setting up a guy who's incredibly important to us who's going to tell me where the loot is and if they're going to come and arrest you, and you'll come loping in like Rambo without a jockstrap and you dangle him out a fifth floor window! Now, was that smart?
Okay.
Was it shrewd? Was it good tactics, or was it stupid?
Don't call me stupid.
Sexy Beast is about the build-up to a heist.
Okay.
So I didn't watch this film on release. I'd seen clips of it, and the clips that I had seen gave me a very skewed impression. I should have known. It's Jonathan Glazer. I love Jonathan Glazer's films, and I always thought that Sexy Beast looked like an outlier amongst them.
Oh, wow.
Because of the title, because of the poster, because of the ooh-ah, oi-oi, sort of Danny Dyer, Brit flick laddishness of it.
Yeah.
But instead, it's like a story of a lunatic played by Ben Kingsley, who is fantastic, rocking up at Ray Winston's villa in Spain after Ray Winston has given up his life of crime and he settled down with his ex-porn star, Mrs., and his gangster pal, and he's living the life. He's got a pool, he loves the sunbathe, he just feels like all his bad days are behind him and he can just chill out. And they get a phone call that Ben Kingsley wants them. He's coming to recruit Ray Winston for a job. It's almost like a chamber piece, except you get into the third act, which is the heist itself. But there are twists and turns in that story, and I don't want to spoil it for you because I really want you to watch it, but it is sensational.
Right.
It's Ray Winston's best performance, I would say. Really romantic on top of everything else. Like Ray Winston, at one stage, he calls up his missus and he says to her, I love you, you know, I love you.
D. I love you like a rose loves rainwater, like a leopard loves its partner in the jungle, like... I don't know what like, I love you. I love you, I love you. I know you know. I know. I know that. I know you love me because I feel strong. I have to go, look, I've got to get back. I'm going to ring up now. I just want you to do one thing for me. Just one. Just say my name for me. Just once.
Cow.
And it's coming at a really tense, terrifying moment. And you're just rooting for Ray Winston to survive and get away with it. So if you haven't, and I was talking to a couple of friends who also all swerved it because of the title, because of what they thought it would be about, go watch it. It's brilliant.
This is the first time I've heard Sexy Beast coming up in so many lists over the years, mentioned by so many film critics. But I've never had anyone explain to me why it's good. And like what you're describing there, I always had the assumption that it was just a geezer teaser, kind of like, you know, a Guy Ritchie, Matthew Vaughn type of lark. And just kind of said that.
Think of it this way. Ray Winstone thinks he's out. The devil turns up, and the devil is prone to violence at the slightest indiscretion. He's a lunatic.
Right.
And they're all terrified of him, and they're all watching their words. They don't know. They don't want him to get involved in this job. And it turns and it twists and it coils around Ray Winstone. And it's brilliant.
Okay.
It's brilliant. It really is. It was written by Louis Mellis and David Cinto, if I've said that wrong. I'm sorry.
And
excellent script. Really well worth watching.
And what's interesting, because I looked at their credits and they don't have that many credits to pair them, which I'm kind of surprised by after writing such a...
It happens, Will.
Oh, sorry. It does happen. It does happen. It does happen.
It happens.
Hey, I think because we are going to be going... I'm definitely going to be talking about films that I'd never mentioned before, but there are a few films that are incredibly famous. Everyone, when you say heist scenes, everyone thinks of them. And I think I love them as well. And I think I'd rather bring them up sooner than later.
Yeah, go for it.
Like, for instance, the heist scene in Mission Impossible, that first Mission Impossible, The Wire, where Tom Cruise is going down and everything.
And I watched the film that inspired that.
Oh, okay. Okay, we'll get to that. So that's, I love that scene. If it's on TV, I will always watch it. It's the perfect example of what you're describing. This team coming together, they all have different roles, they all have to get in, they all have to break in, and it's this precision in how they have to execute the job, and the tension of when it goes slightly awry, like Tom Cruise's temperature has to stay at a certain heat and they can't make any noise, and knowing the parameters that they have to fulfill, knowing all the pieces beforehand and seeing them executed is so exhilarating and so satisfying, and you're on the edge of your seat watching it. It's brilliantly executed. I'm not a huge fan of Brian De Palma, but it's a great high scene.
Toast. Toast. Messy.
Yeah, and now that I've seen the film that it has lifted that sequence from almost entirely, I don't really rate it as highly as I would have.
Mm.
Because there's another film which does all that 30 years prior, and it's as good. There's nothing new in that sequence with Tom Cruise. It's all taken from a film called Top Cappy.
Oh, I've not seen this. No, I've not even heard of this.
In the treasure room, there is a glass case. And in the glass case, there is a sultan. And on the sultan, there is a dagger. And on the dagger, there are the four most beautiful emeralds on earth. The Top Cappy emeralds. They won't be there for much longer, I hope.
You're not thinking of that.
I can't think of anything else.
Top Cappy is directed by Jules Dassin. Jules Dassin, he was a director who I'm sure he's going to come up again because he's done more than one great heist film. But he was in exile because of the McCarthy witch hunts. So he's an American filmmaker that went to France, and he made some incredible films while he was over there. One of them is this. This would be his later work. So it came out in 1964. It's got all the aesthetic of what you think of a 60s film, like The Italian Job. It's quite technicolor. It's a knockabout comedy. It's a ragtag group of thieves that are brought together. Alain Delon is the head of this heist group. You've also got Peter Ustinov in there, who's sort of like a last-minute addition after one of the guys that they need is a strong man. He hurts his hand. And they're trying to steal a scabbard that's on a mannequin in a museum in Turkey. It's like a bejeweled scabbard. And the sequence that Mission Impossible almost lifts one for one is them having to lower this trapeze artist from the ceiling of this museum. And the trapeze artist reminded me of the guy from Ocean's 11. You know, they got the little guy they put in the suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
they have to lower him down on ropes. And it's all pressure sensitive as well. They can't make a sound. So when I was saying, with the great train robbery, it's a silent heist.
Yeah.
This is also the entire sequence. It's like the last 15 minutes is just this sequence. And it is nail-biting. Because what Dassin does, and a couple of other filmmakers that I'll mention, they play out the heist. No score, no talking, no sound effects. It's just process. It's precision. It's the choreography of the actors. And adhering to realism, letting it play out in real time. So you're seeing how they pull it off. They're lowering him down. He's got to write himself. He's got to put the key in, four-sided key. Sure, we've seen that in like other heists.
Yeah.
Unlock the cabinet, attach a second rope to the top of it, slowly lift it up where it can't touch either side. This is all playing out now with no distractions.
Yeah.
You're watching Alain Delon and Peter Ustinov. They're sweating bullets trying to hold the weight of the cabinet. And this guy, he's putting a mark on the rope so that he knows that what height to lower the rope back down again, because he can't see. He's doing this all blind.
Yeah.
Lift it up. The guy's got to go under. He's got to swap out the scabbard for another one. You've got the typical thing of cutting to the security guard who's like listening and kind of can hear something. He's looking around. There's a bird that's fluttering around, and if it gets in, it's going to set things off. All these little things where it's just ratcheting up tension after tension. Just like in Mission Impossible.
He has got it.
He manages to get swap out the scabbard, to lower it down. They get back up and the bird flies in. And here's another thing. So it's a fantastic like heist sequence. Up until then, it's played almost like the Italian Job. It's been an awful lot of comedy hijinks and you know, trying to get the car into the country and smuggling this and smuggling that. And it's very fun. But that last sequence, it plays out as a nail biter.
Okay.
But the thing that jumped out to me when I was watching this, because the repeating themes were starting to reveal themselves as I was watching these films. In almost every heist film, they never get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's only a few, and I don't want to really spoil which ones I'm talking about now, because I think you should watch it and you'll enjoy it. But the only, and I know you've seen this one, the only ones that I can think of that they do get away with it, and there isn't some sort of like Pyrrhic victory or a bit of a sting in the tail, like with the Italian Job, where they've gotten away with it, but they're fucked. They're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
They're never going to get that gold. They're basically caught between a rock and a hard place.
Hang on a minute, lads. I've got a great idea.
Is Logan lucky?
Oh, yeah. I saw that in the cinema and really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Pulling off a job like this, I got to weigh the positive versus the negative. Well, you Logans can just think of it as a plus or minus.
What do you get? Positive and negative.
Okay. So, all cash. That's a positive. But a place like the track, it's gonna have 20 times the security of a bank. So that's negative.
It's a lot of fun. It does something unique to the genre in that it has a heist within a heist,
mm-hmm.
and the second heist gets revealed at the end. So when you think everything's gone wrong, the two lads have actually pulled off a more intricate heist underneath the heist, and all their bases are covered. And Hilary Swank, who's the FBI officer investigating, she's kind of like stumped. She can't sort of, she can't figure it out. I feel like I'm going to sneeze, Will.
Get back, demon.
Jesus Christ.
Be gone, evil demon.
But in Logan Lucky, they get away with it. They get the money. It's a happy ending for everyone. There isn't one person in the group who takes the fall or gets killed or doesn't get away with it. They all get away with it. It's like the most successful heist of all the ones that I watched.
Okay.
They do kind of bring in Hilary Swank at the very, very end where she's in the bar and she gets a drink from Adam Driver, so she's not dropped it. She's going to keep pursuing them. But that's as far as it goes. For almost all the others, maybe Ocean's 11, they get away with it as well. But for almost all the others, crime doesn't pay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was reoccurring the whole way through it. Just specifically on Logan Lucky, because I saw it in the cinema whenever it came out in the late 2010s. I can't remember the specific year. But I don't know, was it just my viewing at the time, or I wonder, does this make any sense? I just remember recalling going away with the sense that it was edited really oddly. Like there was really extra kind of long, it just had a kind of an awkward kind of stilted editing style. And I cannot recall why I felt that. But
I didn't get that from this watch, because I just watched it for the first time just the other night.
Okay. It might have been just the screening I was in or the mood I was in on the night or whatnot. I just remember feeling like scenes just felt like they cut like at a really odd beat. like, you know, like a moment later than you expected or something like that. And I wasn't sure if it was intentional or not. That might have been just my...
With Soderbergh, it would have definitely been intentional because he's someone that's so... He's so driven by form and by process that I think it's... He's always testing the boundaries of what you can do in a film to keep the attention of an audience. Mm. So he's sort of like mastered so many different styles of filmmaking that he just keeps trying odd, quirky things. So maybe, but I didn't notice it.
I would love to go back and revisit that theory. Listen, I'm loving this. Jules Dassin is a name that's going to come up. I'll just put it that way.
Can I just get rid of some major heist films that we're not really going to talk about that everyone has seen?
Go on.
Just in order to knock down these posts, because the ones I really want to talk about I haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah.
Point Break, everybody's seen it. Mm-hmm. That's a really good one. Thomas Crown Affair, I've mentioned it before. Again, it ends on a happier note. Great film. I loved Entrapment, the Sean Connery, Catherine Zeta-Jones film. I don't think it's that well beloved. I love the score to that. I just love the whole vibe of that film. It's like a glossy caper.
I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, I loved it. I also loved the scene where Catherine Zeta-Jones is going under the lasers.
For what reason?
Training. It's amazing. Ronin. Ronin is a great film.
Yeah.
A Fish Called Wanda, I've already mentioned. Sneakers. If you're looking for a heist film that is a frothy, fun caper, I think the best of the best is Sneakers, the Charles Crichton film.
Mm.
Love it. Sidney Poitier, Robert Redford, River Phoenix, Dan Aykroyd. It's like got a stacked cast. Ben Kingsley's in that as well. It's brilliant. I absolutely love that film. To Live and Die in LA, we've mentioned that one before.
Great film.
Great film. But the guys know each other, and so it's more of a con job.
And,
between
and one doesn't one example that doesn't fit into our category right now is the opening scene of The Dark Knight, that bank heist there. It doesn't, we're just opening on the heist itself, but the heist itself, it's a delight.
Another Nolan one, Inception. It's basically a heist film.
Yeah. Kelly's Heroes.
Yeah.
World War II heist.
And Heat. Everybody's seen Heat. Heat's a 5-star film for me.
Here she got a great ass. And you got your head all the way up it. When I think of asses, woman's ass, something comes out of me.
It's not going to be my pick, but it needs to be mentioned.
I was going to mention Heat only for the fact that I did rewatch that scene because I've seen it so many times. And the heist is great. But
it's more of a bank robbery, though. It's just a straight ahead brutal bank robbery.
It is. What's orgasmic about it is the shootout escape, is the getaway. It's more the getaway in Heat that is the exceptional scene where everything explodes. It's phenomenal. It's, you know, listen, it's, every time I watch it, I just get that thrill and I want to rob it. I want to go.
One of those films that once it's on and you catch it, you just got to keep watching.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time. Absolutely. Every time. So yeah, you've kind of knocked down, fair play to you. Those were the things I was going to honorable mention as well. A lot of those films were on my list as well. And I haven't, and you haven't actually hit any of the films that I wanted to bring up. I've got kind of like a couple more I want to bring up.
Okay, so there were three films that are in contention for my pick. Mm. Top Cappy was one of them, because we're talking about heists. So there are films that I love across the board, but it's the heist that I'm zeroing in on.
Yeah.
So if that is the stuff that really works for me, then I'm going to mention that. Ooh, I'm going to save the two, because I have a feeling that you're going to mention...
I think we're going to overlap maybe on one or two here.
Yeah.
Well, can I bring up one that didn't quite make the top of my list, but it was very close. And it was one that is kind of considered one of the early modern heist movies. And it's The Asphalt Jungle.
Only the author of Little Caesar could tell so dramatic a story. Only the director of The Treasure of Sierra Madre could film it with such power. Only once in a decade does the screen come up with such absorbing characters. Sterling Hayden as Dix Handley, a hooligan with a twisted dream. Gene Hagen as Doll, the dime a dance dame who wanted to share that shabby dream.
Let me go with you. Please, Dix, please.
Are you crazy? I'm on the lam. I want it bad, packing heat. If there's any trouble, what good would you be?
I could drive.
No, Doll. I'm wanted on a killing rap. You know what that means.
I don't care. I just want to be with you.
Louis Calhern as Emmerich, the big-time mouthpiece with crime on his mind.
Oh, I suppose a fella should stick to his own trade, but I know some pretty big men around here that might not be averse to a deal like this if they're properly approached. Highly respectable men, I might add.
Sam Jaffe as Doc. He's got $1 million in that little black bag, and a jitterbug cost him every dime.
I love that film as well. I watched it for the first time for this topic. It's one of two Sterling Hayden heist films.
He was a character.
I love both of them.
He was a character.
He was a character.
I did some research on Sterling Hayden. If you want to know who we're talking about, who Sterling Hayden is, if you remember in The Godfather, that incredible scene where Al Pacino...
gets shot in the neck.
Yeah, Al Pacino has to go in and shoot a couple of guys in the restaurant, the police commissioner. Sterling Hayden is a police commissioner who gets shot in the neck and he's going... Rrr. He was one of those guys. I'll just briefly do a quick aside about Sterling Hayden, because he was a character. He always wanted to sail. His first passion was sailing and boats and whatnot. And he came from a fairly rural upbringing and got working on boats and managed to, within a couple of years, earn his own fucking commission as being a captain of his own ship. Got spotted by some talent scout and got offered a contract with Paramount for $200 a week, which was phenomenal money. He had no interest in acting whatsoever, but he was kind of like pegged as, you're going to be a future star. He took the money because it was funding his sailing. He was in World War II. He was a part of the OSS in World War II, which is the American version of the SAS. Did all these incredible operations during World War II. So he'd lived a life before he was properly working in the Hollywood system.
It all comes across on screen as well, because he's a big, stacked, tall brute of a man.
Yeah. He had several marriages and lost a lot of his money in true marriages. And his star didn't break out.
Wasn't he a gambler and an alcoholic?
Yeah, yeah. And he used a lot of his money to finance his sailing expeditions. And then there's this one notable moment in his history that I just zeroed in on. And I went, holy shit, that's a movie. There was a moment where he wanted to do a documentary about an expedition of him sailing around the world on his yacht, right? And he was trying to get finance from different independent studios and stuff like that. It all fell through. And then one of his marriages fell through as well. So he'd no money. And he did a kind of an open casting call for anyone who wanted to go and travel with Sterling Hayden. And all these teenagers answered the call. And he picked the ones with no experience who just wanted to have this kind of like transition year experience. So he hired people who would work for free. And he kidnapped his own kids. And he took his kids on his yacht that went on the lamb. And he sailed off to Tahiti or something like that with these teenagers and his kids. And when they were outside on international waters, he announced to the crew, he says, we are not going to San Diego, because the original voyage was just a small little trip down the coast. And he announced, we're actually sailing across the Pacific. And everyone just went, okay. And so this all happened in the 1950s. It was mad. He was a character. And it comes across in his performance.
I hope nothing weird happened on that boat.
I don't think anyone died. Okay, that's the main thing. I think everyone got back.
There are gradients to weird.
Yeah.
I think there can be.
Yeah, he is a character. He's a character.
Wasn't he offered the role of Quint in Jaws and he turned it down?
I didn't hear this.
Due to Hayden's issues with unpaid taxes, had he accepted the role, most of his paycheck would have gone directly to the IRS, so he turned it down.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm shocked he turned it down, because being such a sailing fanatic.
Yeah, so The Asphalt Jungle is, you know, if you want a film where it's about crime doesn't pay, this is the film, because it just goes to fucking shit for everybody. It is a heist that crumbles and nobody gets out of it alive. Spoiler alert. Mm.
Yeah.
It's a noir, but I loved it.
Yeah, it's very, very, very noir-y.
Excellent film, black as hell. Mm-hmm. Really, it's up there with another film that I think we're going to mention in terms of like crime really, really, really doesn't pay. It's brutal.
Yeah.
I love that film and I would definitely recommend it.
It's the characters. Again, this film has compelling characters that and character actors portraying these characters that when they're on screen, you kind of can't take your eyes off the screen. And that's the case for all the characters. Even Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe has just got a bit part. This is just before she broke out into being a superstar.
She's the floozy.
Yeah, but when she's on screen, she's intoxicating. You kind of can't take your eyes off her. And I love this film. I thought it was great. It's not at the top of my list because the actual heist itself is fairly rudimentary compared to some of the other heists I saw. So that's one of the reasons it wasn't right up there at the top of my list.
The thing that stood out to me about that one as well is that they call it a caper. And I always thought of Capers as being a bit more of a lark, a bit more knockabout, but I guess it's semantics and it was like, that was the name of the job. So they're pulling off a caper.
Yeah.
But it is definitely not what I would consider to be a caper film. It's definitely a noir. Excellent film. Glad I watched it and happy to recommend it.
You may as well, seeing as we're on the Sterling Hayden buzz, should we talk about the other?
On The Killing?
Yeah, with The Killing.
You ever take a few thousand? I figure the loot on this deal at 2 million. There should be that much in the track offices. You like money. You got a great big dollar sign there where most women have a heart. So play it smart. Stay in character. You'll have money. Plenty of it. George will have it. He'll blow it all on you.
Johnny, I'm no good for anybody else. I'm not pretty and I'm not very smart, so please don't leave me alone anymore.
So what makes you think or know that you're going to have several hundred thousand dollars?
Because I do. I just can't talk about it, that's all.
Not even to me, your little shit.
I shouldn't have even mentioned I was going to have it. It's not that I mind. I know I can trust you. But if these other guys
the
ever...
The other guys?
I can't talk about it, Cherry.
Similar
yeah.
vibe.
Yeah.
Very. Nobody gets away with it. It's crime doesn't pay again. Sterling Hayden is front and center of this one. He's more of the lead of this one.
Yeah. And this is a heist where they rob a racetrack. That's what this is. And this one's, of course, directed by Stanley Kubrick in his very, very early career. This is his second feature film. And it was really interesting to watch it because I'm reading that big tome of a book about Stanley Kubrick at the moment.
This is before Kubrick became Kubrick, really.
Yeah. And
he's working with him more the Hollywood style.
It's still considered a kind of independent film, really. But Kubrick had been a photojournalist up to that point. And having read his, currently reading his biography, we've covered the killing. He had gotten a name for his kind of photo stories, you know. So he would go out and he would take a series of photographs, which essentially were like, you know, little mini photo essays.
When he was 15, wasn't it? It was like,
yeah,
when he was very young,
late
he was working
teens.
For the newspaper.
Yeah. But it turned out a lot of them, like, you know, he actually staged all of them, like, you know, most of them. So they would be like, he would just cast his buddies as, let's say, a drunk or someone on a date. And he would cast his sister and a buddy and have them go out on a first date and kind of sell it as, this is a couple who are on a blind date, you know, complete fictional
fake
stuff.
Fake news.
Fake news. And he would go to the racetrack and he would, his first movie was the Fight or The Night of the Fight and whatever I think it is. But it was very much, you know, basically doing the same thing he was doing as a photojournalist, kind of pretending to capture real life, but in actual fact it was staged. So when he went on to make these films, specifically The Killing, it's done in that style where you feel this is a photojournalist kind of following factual incidents. He has this narrator voice who tells you what the time is at 4:45 and at the train tracks, we're here.
It feels like a crime reenactment.
Exactly.
Because it's this person went over here and at this time they went in. The whole film is narrated in a very factual, functional way.
At 11:40 that morning, Nicky left his farm.
So as a journalist, he's now becoming a film journalist, but completely making it all up. So just basically taking his experience up to that point and translating that into the cinema. Again, look, I love the characters are all really interesting.
He arrived at the track at 12:30.
You lean into him. Sterling Hayden is very compelling. There's one scene I loved in it, just from a cinematic point of view. It's the scene where they're plotting around the poker table, where the light's really low, and you've got this cast of characters all gathered around, and the smoke is swirling in the air around them. I just thought that was so gorgeous. Because this film isn't composed as Kubrick's later work. This is pre the supercomposition he has later on. But there's that scene where they're plotting around the poker table that I just couldn't take my eyes off of. I just went, this is painterly. It was so, the way the light was being cast from that low-hanging light on the faces of all these cast of characters around the table. great stuff where they're kind of going through the details of it. And the heist itself, where they, I thought it was so funny. They have one of the characters is this like Russian wrestler. Do you remember that scene? The Russian wrestler basically has to go to the bar and start the fight. And he picks a fight with every security guard in the entire
place. That felt really realistic to me, where I was like thinking, it's not like Batman 66, you know, where it's like kapow, boom. He's actually fucking flinging those guys over his shoulder and they're hopping off the floor. And they didn't look like stuntmen to me. They just looked like regular guys. And I thought, this is incredible fight choreography.
Yeah.
They're probably just doing it for real. And also, these guys are getting really fucked up. Yeah. He's like battering the shit out of them. It was really impressive.
The amount of hair he had in his back was also impressive.
Yeah.
He didn't need to wear a shirt. He had one on. He was growing one.
Yeah, yeah. But that's his job, is to create a distraction. And boy, does he do it. Clever film. You know, it's fun. It wasn't in contention for my best pick. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Loved seeing it. I was noting at that stage the recurring themes and stuff. And another one where it's like, oh, it goes really to shit at the end.
Can I talk about something screenwritery that I brought up before, right? It's the going to shit in the end, right? Thing. Always, it's like an unhappy coincidence that comes along that trips all these jobs up, right? So, and, you know, it only...
Like in The Lady Killers. Like
yeah.
When the cello case gets stuck in the door. They've gotten away with it.
Yeah.
They've pulled it off. It's a frothy comedy with Alec Guinness and Peter Sellers. They're staying at this old lady's house. They've managed to rob the bank. She's oblivious to what's going on. She thinks that they're a little string quartet. They're heading out. They're all, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Thank you so much. Oh, do come around again. Blah, blah, blah. And the guy's cello case gets stuck in the door and he yanks it.
What is that Norrin playing at?
And she opens the door just as all the money bursts out into the road. And then it all goes to shit. Then it's like, we've got to kill her. We can't let her get away with it. And yeah.
Which, funny enough, it reminds me of the ending of The Killing as well. That just what you described there reminds me very close to the end of The Killing, where it's just a couple of little unhappy accidents that happen to Sterling Hayden and, you know, a couple of other characters that causes the whole thing to go.
In Top Cappy, it's the bird. Little bird flies into the museum.
Oh, don't spoil it on me. I'm going to watch that next. But go on.
I'll go
la, 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 and you can say it.
And they all live happily ever after.
Ah.
It's a comedy. So, you know, it's not going to get too, it's not going to go the way of The Killing or Asphalt Jungle, where it's like, oh God, they're actually blowing their fucking brains out or they're dying, bleeding out in a car.
Mm.
Everybody crying. But yeah, it's those, yeah, you've said it before, unhappy coincidences. They should benefit the antagonists, not the protagonists.
Absolutely. That's the key. And that's it. You know, it works. It works. We're on my list, Kevin. I've just got one film left.
I have two films left, and I know the one that you're going to mention.
Okay.
And I'll be honest with you, the one you're going to mention, is this your pick?
Yeah, it's my pick, yeah. And you know what it is.
So, yeah, because it was going to be my pick as well.
Okay.
My pick was going to be Jules Dassin's 1955 film, Rififi.
That's my pick. Jules Dassin, what a legend. Isn't this mad? The last episode we kind of had, we overlapped. We came to the same conclusion. And now we're doing it again.
Well, what can you pick? This is like the archetypal heist film and the one that influenced all the others.
Yeah.
It's got to be my pick. I'm happy with my follow-up one that I can mention, which would be my alternative pick. It was a toss-up between the two of them because I love the other one as well. But go ahead. You tell me, what did you love about Rififi?
Okay, just let me give you a quick synopsis or everyone just a little bit. Just give me a moment.
After spending 5 years in prison, season thief Tony is released and tries to live a quiet life. However, when approached by his old associates, Joe and Mario, Tony reluctantly agrees to take part in one last job, robbing a high-end Parisian jewellery store. The crew includes Caesar, played by Jules Dassin, Italian safecracker, and together they devise an elaborate, flawless plan for the heist. And boy, is that a black-hearted fucking film.
Mm-hmm.
Ruthless.
Oh, Intoxicating. Yeah, intoxicating. It's got a cast of characters that they're quite distinct from... Actually, I don't know the names. The strong man who's got the kid, the wife and the kid. He's got this perfect, happy family at home. He's beautiful. He's got... It's like he's walked off a comic book. He's so square. Like, you know, it's like someone's drawn him.
He looks like Ryan O'Neill. He's got like the blonde curly hair.
Yeah.
But he's the family man. But the lead guy... The lead guy, he comes out of prison and he is fucking pissed. He's aged. He's too old to be doing this. And he's motivated by vengeance as much as anything else. But he's got a real core based on the honor among thieves. But when he's introduced and he goes around to his old girlfriend who's been knocking about since he's been in prison and he beats the shit out of her.
Yep.
This is not a Hollywood movie. This is great. It's like they're showing me a hardened criminal.
Yeah.
They're not pulling any punches, neither is he.
He is despicable. And the only kind of redeeming quality of his character is the fact that he's the godfather to, what's his name? Joe? Is it Joe? Well, he's the godfather to the kid. There's only one kid in the story.
Joe and Mario's little boy, the 5-year-old.
And so...
Who
what?
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil it for people because I'm sure that there aren't that many that have watched a 1955 French film, but I promise you, you're missing out here. But yeah, the little boy becomes a major MacGuffin, we'll say, in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, what I appreciated about this particularly was you could feel this is a film being made outside of the Hollywood system because you get, you know, as you're saying, there's
by somebody there's with a chip brutality. On their shoulder.
Yeah, it's got a harder edge. Jules Dassin had been ejected from the Hollywood system. He had to flee. He had to flee America. And here he is just trying to... And this is a film that didn't get seen in America because of the association, that his name was blacklisted. So it was really hard for distributors to actually get this bloody film, you know, into profit because of the weight his name carries. But the results are so amazing. Like that cast, there's a moment where there's a specific scene where all of this group, the heist gang, are talking about why they're doing it. And they all have, like, you know, one guy saying, oh, it's my kid, I'm doing it for my kid. There's two Italian guys. One guy says, oh, I've got four sisters, I'm going to get them all married off. Another guy saying for his own reason. And we go back to Tony. Why are you doing it? The guy we're talking about who's out of prison and he's got no motivation. He just says, they say, why are you doing it? And it's just like, he doesn't have a reason to do this, which is so tragic, but yet he's going to do it anyway. It's wonderful stuff.
And when the heist unfolds and when it happens, you know, they're building up, they're prepping, they're practicing, they're figuring out how to disengage the alarm because it's pressure sensitive. They've got a drill from above a department store.
Mm.
And not set off this security system that's in place. The heist itself, it must go on for about 30 minutes. And it's all silent.
Yeah.
Nobody speaks. There's no score. There's no histrionics. It's what I said to you on the Assassins episode. There are two things that I love watching in films. I love watching characters think. I love just being with them in a private moment and seeing the gears turn in their head as they're going over things, maybe in their life or what they have to do or whatever. There's moments where you just see somebody at a bar and they're just sitting there and they're just thinking to themselves.
Mm.
And I just find that taps into the inherent curiosity that we all have. We're just people watching. The other thing is process. Watching people execute something that they are highly skilled at doing and they are the best of the best at.
Yeah.
I love watching that. And this heist goes off flawlessly.
You were talking about the process. Seeing these characters execute this heist was so satisfying because we also have a very clear chart of time because this actual heist goes on for something like 6 hours, not 6 hours of screen time, but 6 hours in the film world time. And there's this...
Yeah, because it's going to take them 3 hours just to drill through the ceiling.
Just to just chip away. And they can't say a word. But seeing them look at each other and seeing them working in concert with each other is so incredible. It's the process, using that word, the process of how they're synced up. Everyone knows each other's jobs. Like how when they have to tilt the safe over, the strong guy, the butch guy, uses his own body as a kind of a jack, a lowering jack underneath the safe. And you know if they fuck up, he's crushed. He's splat. But they have this confidence and trust in each other that they're going to execute this to the maximum of their ability. And also, the other detail in that scene is because they have to do it silently, there's these tough guys in suits. They take off their shoes and they put on dainty little ballet slippers, frilly little slippers or sneakers. And it's just this wonderful little kind of detail it's fun.
This is the thing. It's about the details. It's about this adherence to process and reality, nothing else. I look at all these other heist films that have come almost 80 years since that film. I can see now why it established the genre and the things that you need. Asphalt Jungle was great, but it's not what I would consider to be a great heist film like Rififi. Rififi's got to be the best there is in the genre.
Yeah, I loved it. When I was watching it, but this is great. And inevitably, the fallout from the heist is as compelling, and we won't spoil any of that. It's tragic, and it's just, you're on the edge of your seat. That's the point. You're on the edge of your seat, and you've grown to love these characters, you know, even though they're on the wrong side of the law.
And did you notice that the guy, how do I say it without spoiling it? Did you notice that Jules Dassin was playing a part in there?
No. I'm like going, who was Jules? Where was Jules Dassin?
The Italian.
Really?
Yeah. As a director, he cast himself in that part.
Are you sure?
Yes,
1,000%. Because in the credits, he's nuts.
Yes.
Oh, he's down there. He's Caesar. Oh my God, I did not know that was him. Wow, incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. And you also see a little bit of nipple in this film as well.
Yeah, French films. You see nipples a lot.
It's so odd.
The novel, Rififi chez les hommes, had all kinds of strange things happen. Cruel things, including necrophilia. And I didn't know what to do with it. I at first said, no, I don't want to do this. But there's a passage in the book which had to do with a robbery, which was to finance a big, greater project. And I ceased upon that to build a screenplay, much of screenplay, around it. And make it a high point in film. And many people ask me why silence, because there's not a word spoken for a long time. And I said, these are professional guys who work in silence. Noise is an enemy. All men adopted noiseless shoes, so to speak. And I thought it was right for César to have ballet slippers. I enjoy that. I like the man who wrote the music for the film was the wonderful Georges Auric. And he said, oh, this will be a long sequence, because it goes almost about a half hour or so before and after, of no dialogue at all. And he said, I'm going to write you a big hunk of music there. And I said, don't do that. I don't want music. He said, listen, I'm going to write music to protect you. You can't go on the film half hour without a word said. And the producer sided with him. And he wrote it. He wrote a huge piece of music. And then I asked him to come to see the film once with music and once without music. And it was Auric who said, no music, pas de musique. And I liked him for that.
I fucking love that. That's my pick. This was in contention. I watched this film last night and I thought, oh God, you know what? This might actually be my pick. Mm. Could I go with this one? But then I thought, Rififi comes first. So I'll go with the one which established the rules of the genre.
Right.
And that did it so successfully. This one, however, I fucking loved it. It's not directed by Jules Dassin. It is another French film. It's directed by Melville. Oh. It stars Alain Delon, and it's called The Red Circle, or the Circle Rouge.
Il n'y a pas d'innocents. Les hommes sont coupables. Ils viennent au monde innocents, mais ça ne dure pas.
Tu es le seul à qui j'oserais proposer une affaire. Classique, sûr, sans risque, si elle est bien faite. Et si elle est mal faite?
Je vous charge de retrouver vos gènes par tous les moyens. Et quoi qu'il vous en coûte.
Vous pensez qu'il va réussir?
Il arrivera. Pour une fois, le gibier est intelligent.
Ce sera de l'ordre de 2 milliards d'anciens francs. Prix de vente.
Il reste à trouver le tireur d'élite. J'ai connu il y a 4 ou 5 ans un très bon tireur. Un policier.
Il faudra reconnaître les lieux. Ça, ce sera vous.
It was directed by Jean-Pierre Melville, came out in 1970. It begins with Corey, played by Alain Delon, a cool, professional criminal being released from prison. He quickly finds himself drawn back into a world of crime, and through a series of circumstances, he teams up with two other men. It was a three-man heist. Vogel, an escaped convict, who's busted out of... He's being transported by train, and he's cuffed to the guy, and he breaks out. He gets out of the cuffs, and he goes on the lam. And an ex-police marksman with a drinking problem. He's an older guy. You were talking about Rafifi, where they ask Tony, why are you doing this? And he has no reason. The ex-marksman is doing it because he's haunted. He's having these nightmares in it. There's a nightmare scene in this that takes place where he's being crawled all over by spiders. It's like, Jesus Christ. It feels like a spy movie, but it's not. The three guys come together to rob these jewels from a safe. They need the marksman to shoot a shot through the bars to open the buzzer that's by the safe. He's also padding around with his shoes off. He takes off his shoes and he's running on the carpets and it's completely silent. And he's like,
I love silence. I love pitter patter. I think I love little dainty little tough guys now. Every tough guy should be dainty. Have dainty little feet.
So this also, the whole heist takes place in silence. There's not a word spoken between the three guys. They've trained for it, they've practiced for it, they get in, they do a job. The job takes a while. Tie up the security guard in a cell and he's trying to strain to reach the alarm system. Three guys have individual specific jobs. He's got to set up his gun, take the shot. It's a really great moment, right? The aging marksman guy, where he gets the tripod, he sets it up, he's doing all the little gears, he's counterbalancing it, he's lining it up. They're looking at him, they're fucking tense, they're thinking, you know, he's got to make this shot. It's about 60 feet away and it's like a little pinprick he's got to hit. And what does he do? He just grabs off the stand and he takes the aim and he freehands it and bang, he gets it. The door's open. They get away with it and then the rest of the film unfolds and similar to Rafifi, things go fucking south. There's a really touching moment where the aging cop guy, and I don't want to spoil it too much for you, you've got to watch it, you love it.
I will definitely
watch
it.
He says to him, I'm not taking the money, you guys need it, you take it. And they're like, why? You got to take your cut, why did you do it? And he said, the reason I did it has been done now, and that it served its purpose. So he's gotten rid of his nightmares. He's no longer going to be haunted by them. It's a tiny little moment. It's really touching. There are police officers involved who are trying to set up a sting operation on top of everything else to catch them. They don't know that one of their own guys has been in on it. This is another recurring theme that happens in a lot of these heists, is there's a guy on the inside, there's a cop who's dirty, there's a person who knows the safe. I love those little details. You'll have the family man, you'll have the lone wolf guy, the guy who doesn't know having anything else in his life except this, like Dr. Schneidenreiter or whatever. But yeah, right at the very end, it's the last film I watched for this topic, and I thought, fuck me, I've ended on such a high note. Is this my pick? Because I adored it from beginning right through to end. And you know I hate my French films. I
despised them.
I despised them. I just hate the language. I hate the language. It's superb.
It's on my... I've added a few films to my watch list here, and I always, you say, oh, you're ready, but you'll never watch it. I always generally get around to them, but I'm going to get to these sooner than later because I just want to keep rowing with this topic. It has been incredible. These films have been amazing. Jewel Stassen has been incredible. I want to watch all these films. And can't believe it. It's like, I'm kind of sad that it's gone now, that we're done.
Yeah, in terms of research, this has been an absolute treat for me. I've loved watching all these films. I didn't hit one speed bump. There wasn't one film where I thought, oh, that's shit. The closest I get is that, oh, that's a great film, but it doesn't really fit the brief.
So yeah. Yeah. It's not to say that there haven't been bad heist films. There have been terrible heist films along the way.
Check out our Letterboxd. We'll do a Letterboxd list. We do it for every single episode. There's a link in the show notes. If you click on that, you can see all the films that we've mentioned. There's not one bad one on that list.
Yeah.
I'm kind of glad that Jules Dassin was ostracized because he got to make these films.
Yeah.
But it's a tragedy that people didn't get to see them.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah.
Rectify that.
We've done this topic, Kevin. We've covered it.
We have.
There's something that came. Do you want to know? There's actually something I forgot to bring up as a bit of a side trivia about Ocean's 11. And Ocean's 11 was a huge hit, the one with George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and
Matt Damon.
That film then went on to influence the proliferation of online casinos, which is incredibly ironic. So,
really?
Yes. I did not realize this. It was when that film came out, was it 2000, 2001? Still, the internet was, you know, in its nascent age, like, you know, not what it is now today.
It was where you had to, like, wait for the JPEG to, like, download. Yeah. Like,
nipples. Yeah. Oh, we've got all six nipples. Yes, we've got all six nipples. That's great. You know.
That's a fine Frisian.
Yeah. Well, casinos piggybacked on the success and tone and aesthetic of Ocean's 11 to design the online. So, oh my God, the film that was about, you know, robbing an online casino then inspired casinos to rob people online.
One of my favorite film scenes comes from Ocean's 11.
Oh.
And it's not a heist scene. It is a gorgeous scene. And I strive to write moments like that often with my scripts. I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but it's the first introduction to each other again of George Clooney and Julia Roberts, where he sits down opposite her. He's just gotten out of prison and they've had a history. She's broken up with him, and the back and forth that happens between them, it's just chef's kiss.
Mm.
And it ends with that lovely, lovely line.
Does he make you laugh?
Mm.
He doesn't make me cry.
Oh my God, that's such fucking beautiful writing. And yeah, it's not a heist scene, it's in a heist film, so I guess I can mention it. No, I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but as I was saying to you, the writing in heist films is fucking top notch.
Yeah.
You've got sharp screenwriters trying to pull off an elaborate scheme and entertain you, and it's all driven by the characters.
Absolutely.
Love this topic. Yeah. Love these films.
It's the best genre.
So now, Will, this is a topic for you.
Oh my God.
And I've picked it. Nobody else has picked it.
Okay, I've no idea. Okay, this is terrifying. Shit.
And we all know you love your horror films.
Okay.
And as this episode is going to be coming out right at the eve of Halloween.
Okay.
I think that we should do something genre related.
Right.
So I don't want to leave it up to chance. I don't want to spin the wheel. I don't want to ask the patrons, because I want us to sort of like do something which is targeted for the time that it comes out.
Mm.
And I do up these little bespoke covers for all the little episodes. Check out my art on the podcast app. I just like making them. It's like doing those little funny doodle themes for the mini bits. I just like doing them. It sort of like keeps me out of trouble. And keeps me isolated from everybody, where I've got no social life. But I already did one out for kill scenes.
Okay.
And there's blood dripping down onto the logo. So, kill scenes. That's your topic for the next episode.
Oh, okay, so best kill scene.
Best kill scenes. Yeah, not best death scenes. We're haunted by that topic. We did a whole episode, best death scenes, and we lost the guests recording.
Yeah.
And but that was more about, you know, the terms of endearment, the forest cup, the sad deaths. Kill scenes is people getting offed. Doesn't have to be slashers.
Horror. Yeah, we can go into other genres with this. It doesn't have to be horror.
No, it, Yeah, it could be. But it should be fun.
Yeah, that's all. These are fun. I'm looking forward to seeing all these people killed and massacred over the next couple of weeks.
Just focus on death.
Can we just do High Scenes 2? High Scenes 2, so I can keep watching heist movies. That'd be great.
We can do, but it'll be on the Patreon, so you can tell us what you've caught up on the Patreon.
You know what I'm faced with right now in real life? I have to heist myself out of this cabinet. I've heisted myself in. I now have to heist myself out.
I think you're in a closet, not a cabinet. You're not that fucking squashed.
It's some sort of closet. It's a cabinet. I don't know what it is. Right. It's man-made. And I think I'm locked in. That's all I'll say. And the oxygen is... Yeah, it's, I'm feeling a little bit lightheaded. Well, listen, hey, why don't you come along and join us on Patreon for the price of less than the price of a coffee per month, where you can get access to our bonus shows, our regular mini bits episodes, which we drop in between the main shows, which are as long and as fun and packed with content as the main show itself. You can come and join us on our Discord, where we chat and hang out with our friends, as it said on the sign off. And if you can't do that, you could go and give us a thumbs up on your, or a rating on your podcast catcher of choice. And please, 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 if you haven't done it, give us a review on one of those things, like your Apples or your Spotify, because whenever we get reviews, it bumps us up. It does something to the algorithm and exposes. So I enjoyed this topic so much. I enjoyed this little hangout, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
And we'll see you on the next one.
All right.
Kill scene.
Okay.
Can't wait.
A goodbye.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider becoming a Patreon member, where you'll receive bonus shows where we talk about recent releases and what we're up to.
And you'll receive access to our Discord chat room, where we hang out with our listeners.
Search the Best Bits podcast on Patreon or click on the link in the show notes.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Will!
Where you at?
Let's go!
Hello, Boxy Kevin. People think I'm fucking mad.
No more saying cuss words, guys! It's inappropriate and violent!
We can't get these out of the main feed, right?
Hot cock and the c***.
Now where am I to f***? Let me see your hands up!
What? I can't f***. Finish the sentence.
Let me see your hands up.
I can't finish the sentence.
God, you're
ignorant.
Let me see your hands up.
The best fucking podcast.
Get ready to get fucked. Let's do it.
Mini bits.
Subscribe.
All of that shit.
You fuck.
Well, you've an awful fucking tongue on you.
Well, listen, it just came out of me. It was one of those spontaneous expulsions that I do every now and again.
You said that you would save the more rotten part of your travel journey for this episode. Do you want to get into that?
Oh, shit. Right, okay. Okay, all right, I'll tell you.
Have you forgotten about it?
No,
it
I do.
2 weeks ago, and you know.
Yeah, I can
that's
tell.
Like a fucking lifetime ago.
It was a lifetime ago. So I was due to come back, right? Fly back from Oklahoma on my own, right? Which is great. You know, I love traveling on my own. And we had to leave really early, to leave like 4 a.m. because it was like a 3-hour drive to where we were staying, to Oklahoma City. So I drove from there back to the airport. It all went grand. It's a bit nerve-wracking driving on the freeway in the middle of in the dark. You know, it's a little bit.
You were driving?
Intense. I was driving, yeah. I was doing most of the driving. Yeah. So
really? So you hired a car and you were driving out there?
Yeah. So, well, like, the company had a car, so I was driving it mostly.
But you know what I mean.
And so we got there, and I got to the airport. Everyone got through security. Everything seemed okie dokie. Everything was fine. Got to my gate really early. Got onto the plane. And we're sitting on the plane, kind of waiting. And waiting and waiting, and the pilot comes along and he's kind of going, yeah, we should be leaving now in a few minutes. And
what, he turns up late?
He doesn't turn up. He was there. But I looked out my window and I saw this guy. I was just kind of above the wing a little bit, and I saw this mechanic underneath the wing looking up at the wing, and he was kind of going, shrugging, going, I don't know, take pictures of it and stuff like that. And
taking pictures of scratches. I don't know. It's going to need a lot of body work.
Yeah. Kicking tires and all that sort of stuff. And after about 20 minutes, the pilot said, oh, we're going to have to do something about the plane because there's a sensor that says we're broken.
I don't want to take off because, you know, to be honest with you, I'm getting a bad feeling here, but it's up to yourselves. We'll vote on it.
And the pilot says, well, you know what? We're going to do the tried and tested message of turning it off and turning it on again.
Right.
So he went and took him a half an hour to turn it off.
Here, we'll take a run at it and see how we get on.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't feel comfortable about this situation. But I needed to get home. And so that didn't work, basically. And after about an hour of sitting on the plane, or more than an hour anyway, definitely, he said, everyone, you've got to get off the plane. Take all your shit, get off the plane. So we went back out to the gate again. And out of the gate.
You put on your shoes and put on your socks.
Everything. Yes, just completely dress up, yeah. All that sort of stuff. And got out of the
gate.
Do
you take your shoes off on the plane?
No, I unloosen my belt. No, I don't. I do unloosen my laces. So, long story short, the plane wasn't going to fly. And there was one woman working at the desk, and she said, I'm going to call every... And I knew I had a connecting flight to get back home. So I had like this window, small window in Chicago to be able to make the connection to go to the other flight. Anyway, I saw the clock ticking because it was about a 3-hour flight up to Chicago. And the woman who was working behind the desk said, I'm going to call everyone up one by one so we can rearrange your flights. And I immediately said, that ain't going to work because there's a lot of people here and there's only one of you. And sure enough, it wasn't going to work. Because it took her about half an hour to deal with one person. And eventually she put like some cards. She put like some business cards on the desk and she got on the mic and she says,
everyone, if you want to go try and contact an online customer service advice person, they can help you.
Oh God, it's stressing me out already.
Yeah, and I went, oh shit. Okay, I got it. And the other thing, it was like an internal flight. So there was a number of old age pensioners there who didn't have a fucking clue what was going on. And they were turning to me because I was like, I give off dad vibes and I didn't have kids on me. And they were like going, what did she say? And she said, whoa, look, she says we're fucked.
Does this plane stop at Chicago?
Yeah. So I get, and this one man, I got this, I went up and I took a card and I went, I gotta fucking do this shit. And this little old man came up and he went, excuse me. Could you tell me what that lady said? And she said, there's one of these cards up here. I'll get you one. And she says, you can contact someone there and they might help you rearrange your flight. And he took it and he read the card. He sat down beside me. He read the card and he said,
are you Eddie Marzen?
Oh, no. What he said was, this seems to require some sort of smart telephone. And I haven't got one of those.
Because of the war.
I'm 93 years of age. And I just went, oh man, oh, you're 93. Listen.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I was like, okay. I said, right, I got it. I said, okay, listen, I'll try and give them a quick call. And once I'm done here, I'll try and help. I'll help you, okay? He was like, well, thank you very much. And I got online and I ended up connecting with some guy called Bill, right? And Bill and me had an adventure.
Okay.
So Bill was on the phone. Okay. Bill could see me and hear me, right, through my phone.
This is the teaser now for the episode to entice people to want to keep listening.
You asked me. You asked me.
Spice it up.
You asked me.
Spice it up. Does anyone fucking fight?
You asked me, right? So Bill could see me and hear me, right? And but I could only read Bill's responses on my phone. So it was like 24, right? It was like an
episode. Bill could see you and hear you?
Yeah, he could see and hear me via my phone, but I couldn't.
You were on FaceTime.
So it was effectively like their FaceTime, but I could only I couldn't see Bill or hear Bill. I could only get text messages from Bill because I couldn't. I tried to put my phone to my ear and he was like a little mouse. He was like, you know.
Hello, sir.
And I was like, hello, I can't hear you.
Hello, sir.
I cannot hear you. And then he started messaging me saying, I'll just text you, but I can hear you. And I learned
horrible.
This. And I was like, explained. I was like, okay, this is where I am. I'm trying to get this connecting flight. Here's my reference number. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Bill starts messaging me shit like this. He goes, okay, go to gate 5 in capitals now. So I was like, okay, all right, okay, where the fuck is gate 5? So I just get up, I grab my bag, and I just start running through the airport, and I get to gate 5, and he's going, okay, he's messaging me as I'm running, going, okay, we're going to go OAKIDTTDUB. And I said, what are you saying, Bill?
A-OK on O-A-K.
Yeah.
It's who's on first?
What do you mean, Bill? And he says, I'm going to get you to Houston. And then from Houston, you're going to go to Washington. From Washington, you're going to go to Dublin.
He's looking to his colleague going, I got this fucking guy on the phone. Fucking yeah. Diddly eye guy. Doesn't know what the fuck's going on. O-A-K, sir.
So I get to gate, the Houston gate, right? And there was one woman working there, and she was lovely. And he said to me, if there are any people waiting in line, jump the queue. I was like, okay. And he says, jump the queue now. So I was tipping everyone on the shoulder, going, excuse me, I'm sorry. Do you mind? And to be fair to absolutely everyone I met, they all let me jump the queue.
Did you play up your Irishness? Oh, excuse me, dear. Could you get up to the front there? So I have to get back to Ireland. I don't know where I am at all.
I've got to get back to the potatoes.
I've got Bill on the phone. Bill, they're letting me pass. Oh, God, it's great altogether.
Oh, man.
You're very good, though. I'll get a best card for you.
So I get to the lady in the front, and I say, lady in the front, hi, I'm on talking to Bill here. And Bill tells me, she says, he needs to get my bag off that plane right now and get put onto your plane. And she was like, well, let's go help you out, sir. And she was like, going, okay, I'm getting in touch with a guy. Okay, they're getting your bag off the plane. And says, right, okay, he's putting into our plane. We're going to get you on this flight, which is leaving in 9 minutes, right? We're going to get you on this flight, sir. And I was like, going, oh, thank Christ. And then she says, oh, there's a problem. And I was like, going, what's the problem? I can't get you unbooked off of the Aer Lingus flight that's taking you home, because it's a different, you know, different thing. Anyway, long story short, Bill had to go.
Short.
Like, I know, you asked me. Long story. Bill is trying to get me off the Aer Lingus flight. Bill can't get me off the Aer Lingus flight, and we're sitting there as people are boarding, and I'm asking the lady, I'm saying, how many minutes are left? And she's going, two minutes are left. And then Bill says to me, I'm going to get you on this flight. Long story short, Bill doesn't get me on the flight, but he says, he said, you've got to go get your bag. He says, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to get you to LA.
God.
You're going to go to LA, and then you're going to fly home from LA. Right.
So did you go to LA?
So now I'm going to LA, right? But first,
oh my God, can I just tell you one of my stories, though, just to, you know, mix things up a bit.
What?
So I had to go and I had to get something to eat there at lunchtime, and I went up to so there's a supermarket up by me, and the supermarket, it's Tesco.
Mm-hmm.
And Tesco's up the road, so when I go up the road to get something to eat, I'll go into Tesco, and in Tesco,
go on.
Sorry. Stop looking at me. Oh, God. I was going to drag that way out. Way out.
I know. You started this train. I'm going to finish it now. I'm taking this all the way.
And so they have meal deals. No, continue.
Oh, shit. Next thing that happens. So long story long. He says, to get on your flight to LA, you need to go back out to the front of the fucking airport, all the way out through departures, go get your bag as if you're collecting it from a flight, and start the whole process of going through security. I go up to the initial check-in counter and go through the security. So I go right back outside. I'm running now. I've got 25 minutes. The clock is ticking again now. 25 minutes to get the flight to LA. Right. Bill's still with me the whole time. Bill's telling me, fucking run, in all caps. Go.
Did you have on your wheelies?
I wished I had wheelies, or I wish I had some little trunk that had some sort of scooter that had, you know, electric scooter with me. I go out, get my bag.
Push somebody off one of those carts, jump on and hijack the cart.
Go back up to the United Airlines you know, check-in desk where he's telling me, jump the queue, jump the queue, jump the queue. I tap loads of people on the shoulder to jump the queue. I reach a United's...
second time. Yeah,
yes, this is what I'm telling you. I had to do the whole process all over again. I finally get to the customer, the lady who works for United's, and I'm holding up the phone and Bill's telling me, tell her I need her assistance. Tell her I need her assistance to get on this flight. And I go up, holding up the phone and says, I'm sorry, our flight was cancelled. I'm talking to an assistant right here. He says he needs your assistance. This lady says to me, sir, this United lady said, sir, you need to finish working with the online assistant before you talk to me. And I says, but Bill needs to speak to you. And she goes, sir, you need to finish speaking with the online assistant before you discuss it with me. And I went, and Bill is literally screaming, hold the phone in front of her face and show her these words. I need to talk to you. You need to help me. I am the assistant. I need your help. And she would not engage. And I just saw Bill typing in small caps,
fuck her.
I apologize. He just said, I apologize. And I grabbed my bag and I walked away. Like he said, that was the last chance. That was the last chance to leave. And I walk away to the corner of the, you know, the big open area, not even the check-in, the outside, basically by the taxis. And I'm just sitting there going, fuck. And Bill is there messaging me saying, I'm so sorry, Will. Bill and Will. And he said, look, I'm going to get you arrange a hotel for you and all this sort of shit. Now, as this is going on...
That was nice of him. So you got home in the end anyway.
As this is all going on, right? There's more.
I just need to tell you, it's 14 minutes.
You asked me.
We have no thing to... But we've nothing to put at the beginning of the episode. We can't put a 14-minute clip at the beginning of the fucking episode.
You asked
it won't
me.
Fit.
Yeah, you asked
it
me.
It won't fit.
You asked me.
I'll have to cut it down to 6 minutes.
You asked me. I need to finish the story. I need to finish the story. This is why you said you had some trouble. And I said, listen, I'll tell you at the next episode, right? So I'm there looking at my phone, right? I'm there looking at my
Jesus
phone.
Christ.
And Bill is messaging me. Bill and me are sharing details.
This is the reverse of me interrupting you. This is where you... I started the story.
I'm finishing the story.
I'm finishing. I'm going all the way to the end. And you're going to sit there and you're going to listen. And I'm going to keep going.
And...
What was Bill's surname?
What happened was, as I'm sitting standing there talking to Bill...
Wachowski.
The woman who refused to help me out... She eventually dealt with all her customers and she kind of, you could tell she had one, she glanced over and she saw me and she kind of started to feel a little bit like, oh, that guy. And she kind of came over and she said, sir, show me your details. Show me your details. She called me over.
Bob, what's wrong with him?
She called me over, right? And she took my details.
Where's your carer, sir?
She took my details and she was tippy-tappy in the computer. And she looked at me incredulously and she said, but sir... You're supposed to be on the LA flight. You were late for the LA flight right now, sir.
Jesus.
And I said, I know. That's what I was trying to fucking say to you. I fucking know. Like,
I want to strangle her.
Yes. I'll put there's an end to the story. There's another little bit to the story.
But we'll save it for the next episode.
Okay. If you want to hear the end of it, come back to us, right? I will save it for the next set. There is actually another leg to the story. Two legs. Oh, three legs. But seriously, when you asked me, you had trouble. And when I came on the last recording, I was saying, I'm exhausted.
I know exactly how you feel.
Start the timer.
On this episode, we're going to talk about Agatha All Along, The Penguin, The Substance, and Beetlejuice. So make sure you subscribe to our Patreon where you can hear us talk about that.
Many things.